This was recorded at the 6th Jimwag Live event, The Dark Side of Social Media, on June the 19th, 2007 in London. Featuring on the panel, James Cherkov of Collaborate Marketing, Cristiano Ventura of Microsoft's Windows Live Spaces, identitologist and entrepreneur Luke Rizel, Tim Ireland of Bloggerheads, and Mike Barrett from Compound Media, with Sam Michel of Chinwag chairing. The event was produced by Mike Butcher of tbytes.com, with podcast services provided by Perfect Path Consulting. Part 2.
This is probably a good time to start bubbling away with questions. Does anybody have any questions they would like to put to the panel? Hands up, please. We've got one, two, over by the bar. Obviously, the bar is the place to ask questions from.
Can you tell us? I'll try not to talk too loud.
That's cool. Can you tell us who you are, please? As well?
My name is Roger Kondrat. I'm a social media consultant. Anyway, my curiosity is everybody's starting to go with registrations on their comments, which is all fine after the Kathy Sierra incident. I'm wondering if anybody's experienced a significant drop in their comments due to that, because personally, I don't really like registering to every single site that I would like to comment on.
Mike, Cristiano, Mike?
So I think one of the experiences with building these systems is, yes, absolutely. Like, you can get no comments at all if you put registration in front of something that previously would get an average of 5 to 10 comments per post. I think the flip side to that is, from a publisher's perspective, is how genuine, and so where do you set the bar to filter out all of the noise? And so that's different with different audiences, it's different with different topics even. But from a publisher's perspective, that's absolutely key. If you get the bar in the right place, you filter out all of the rubbish, and you only get people that are genuinely passionate about the subject, or that are generally passionate about spamming or being abusive about the subject. Right? You filter out all of the people who won't register. And, you know, clearly you get registrations from people with false email addresses and stuff like that.
You can spot them, generally.
And you can spot those. And I think what's really interesting about this is how is building the systems that enable that to be managed. So the ultimate example of that is GameSpot in the US, where the audience are gamers, right? So their objective is to beat the system. It's all about getting a great reputation on GameSpot. So their systems in the background are pretty sophisticated, and they're tunable so that they can tune out the people who are beating it. But ultimately, your post will get on the site if you've got a great reputation, and your reputation is based on what other people say about your posts. It's based on the amount of traffic that goes to your contributions. And so the cream will rise to the surface, and if you just sign up and you post something and the system doesn't know who you are, the chances of that getting on the site pretty slim, to be perfectly honest, because they're getting 40 million impressions a day.
So there's an investment in time.
Massive investment, but the investment in time in creating the systems mean that you don't have to moderate it, and it's a self-policing society. Now, clearly, that audience are trying to beat the system. So they've had to build something pretty robust, and that wouldn't be the same for, I don't know, Mothercare. It's different audiences are going to require different levels, but absolutely setting the bar is really, really important.
Cristiano, what's the Microsoft experience?
Well, I guess our solutions is less sophisticated, and to answer your question, no, we haven't seen a drop in commenting. I guess the reason why we did not have the need of having a sophisticated solution is because the perception of the spaces, or live spaces, it is of a closed network. So the kind of people that you ended up talking to or leaving posts to are your friends. So it's the kind of self-policing. However, what we've seen that in some instances where there were live spaces which were public and they have topics which were quite interesting for a wider audience, then suddenly the self-policing kicked in, and people start reacting to nasty comments left by anonymous bloggers, that kind of things. So it's probably the community itself which is regulating.
And I think that's part of it as well. So part of those tools are the community tools. So they operate. So I'm not sure exactly the algorithm that goes behind it, but it's basically a three strikes and you're out. So if the community complains about you enough, then your reputation starts to suffer. And for those guys, it's all about reputation in the community, just as it is offline.
What if you're attacked by a bunch of sock puppets who start attacking your reputation?
Yeah, I mean, Dig's a great example of that, isn't it? We were talking about before the event. For me, Dig is not a particularly positive example of community, and I think I mean, maybe it's interesting to look at the concept of community and to realise that it's neutral in itself. Communities can be very positive and creative, or they can be quite destructive. And I think the dig mentality can get very aggressive because the system incentivises quite aggressive behaviour.
Is everybody aware of what dig is? It's most people. Dig is a very simple tool for giving a thumbs up or a thumbs down to a web page or a URL, essentially. It tends to be dominated, and feel free to disagree, by American men sort of between 18 and 34 who it's the wisdom of their particular crowd.
And so even if it's not deliberate, they have their own little cliques that develop. So, you know, 12 guys who just happen to be related or happen to vote for the same link at the same moment, get it past a certain threshold so other people can see it and maybe they start voting for it. You know.
So before we go off into dig gaming, which we can come back to, there was another question over by the bar. Oh, sorry, over there.
Hey, Ben. Whoa. I'll hold this further away. Hey, it's Ben from Neoco. Don't you think that all of this discussion is just kind of a little bit aimless, because really it's just the next thing for a technophobic media to jump onto and create these sensationalist stories about. For example, the MySpace party where, you know, everyone crashed this party and smashed up a house worth £25,000 worth of damage, etc. I can remember being at school and knowing that somebody's going to have a house party, and so 50 of my mates turn up. And then we all go in and, well, you know, there was damages caused and stuff like that. But, that's it. I wasn't there. But and as surprising as it may be, that I was actually young before MySpace was around. And it's one of those things that even, like, with paedophilia and identity theft and all of that lot, everything like this has always gone on before the internet, before social media, and it's going to carry on, and whatever the next technology, it will happen. And I think that it only seems to be, sorry, I think it only seems to be relevant for the circle of friends. So where you're talking about people doing sock puppets and stuff like that, and it all goes back to, and I think, I can't remember who said it on the panel there, but someone said about it being like a school playground, and I think that's the very best analogy. And it's where this sock puppet, and it only matters when it actually affects the reputation amongst your actual peers. And if they are your peers, and if they do know you, and if they really are your friends on Facebook, then they would know what kind of comment that you would make and you wouldn't make. And so it's less likely to actually impact your reputation overall.
It's not necessarily people impersonating you. It's one person pretending to be 12 people, which really intimidates people. Let me tell you what the internet can do that that hasn't existed before. I'm going to just pretend, Ben, that you've got kids.
And pretend. Not I know of, but pretend.
Yes, pretend. And you've got opinions, and you voice an opinion, and you attract the attention of someone who doesn't think they get satisfaction from your reply, and they decide to take it further. They have a look through MySpace to try and find the most likely candidate for your kids. Okay? Now, all they have to do to intimidate you is get close enough to the school and start trouble amongst the students at the school. That is something that is going to possibly impact on your children, if not intimidate you as an act. I mean, before the internet, those two things couldn't be plugged together.
Potentially, but what I think is that, you know, kids will be kids in terms of if someone's going to get bullied at school, they're going to get bullied at school.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about here is an adult pretending to be a kid and hoping that they'll slip under the radar because there are people saying, oh, kids will be kids.
Christiana, you had something to add?
Yeah, I think we're just probably talking about the same thing, that the internet is like real life, actually. It mirrors, but what it does more is just magnify what's happening in real life. I don't think that we should have a different approach. I think that what we should do, we just start applying the skill set, the parental skill set that we have. I mean, we know what privacy is all about. We have a vague experience. I do agree with you. Parties happened 10 years ago before MySpaces and houses were trashed. Now they get the press because rather than 20 people, they turn up being 100 people. It's not about reinventing the wheel. It's just about clear what the media hype is all about. I mean, some of the stats that I was pretty pleased to read about children and teenagers abducted online. First of all, we only talk about teenagers. And it's a small percentage, I was telling the panel earlier on, just 5 or 7% of teenagers have been violently abducted because of the internet. Not something that we should undermine, but it's not the big hype that the media are selling us. So in a nutshell, we do have the skills, we just need to tell people, we need just to clear the clutter and help the media in understanding, the parents in understanding what this is all about. And then some common sense and behavior.
But just to play devil's advocate to what the internet allows you to do now, the flip side of that is that, and clearly the police need to get smarter at this because, you know, there's been some obvious slip-ups. But actually, it's not that difficult for the police to find out who went to the party, which 20 years ago you wouldn't have been able to do. And so that's a kind of flippant remark. But in the paper today, there's, you know, a paedophile ring that's been, you know, four guys have been sent to jail. And that's only as a result of some policemen in Canada, who clearly wouldn't have been working on a UK case, there's 15 UK children involved in this. And so these people are leaving a trail now. So you're right, that wasn't possible with the internet before, but actually it wasn't possible to track these people before. And so they're leaving a trail, and these guys who got put away today, they're the, you know, they're the dealers, right? They're not the users of this material. They're the dealers, so they're cutting stuff off at source. So I think that's really interesting that, you know, there's a flip side to all the bad stuff, which is the good stuff. And this was on page 4, right? So it doesn't get on the front pages because it's not about MySpace and it's not about Facebook. But it is about good, effectively, forensic policing online. And I think that's something that doesn't get reported.
Well, you know what they say about newspapers, if it bleeds, it leads. So I guess the tools are better both on the good side. But
this is where the internet community can make the difference. Again, is that clean the clutter and make sure that people understand what we're talking about. I don't know if you are aware, but all the larger social networks, including ourselves and Vodafone and Orange, joined together to try to draft some guidelines of best practice for social networking. This before the government started drafting rules that potentially may not be appropriate. So there is the willingness not to regulate, but at least to come out with best practice and help people in making the most out of their internet experience. Cool.
So more questions from the floor? I saw another hand up. There's another hand over there.
Hi.
Hello.
Andy from Media Week.
And over there. Sorry, I missed you behind all the people. Go ahead.
Yeah, we've all heard examples this evening of terrible cases of security breaches or people abusing other people online, etc. I mean, for me, I was just proposed a question to the panel, which is, there's so many security issues out there that if, say, MySpace or a third party can come up with some system where they can guarantee that your personal information will remain private, they can make a hell of a lot of money out of this. So can MySpace, for example, charge a 5 or 10 or a year or whatever and guarantee that your profile will only be privately viewed, etc.?
Good question. So if someone solves the identity problem, do they win in the social network game? Luke, do you want to come back on that?
Well, of course, even if they give you that guarantee, they can't override the Patriot Act. So the US government can access your information, you know, any time they see fit. That's one important angle to remember there as well. But I think there clearly is value in services offering privacy. I'm not sure if it's something that sells a service in itself, but I think there's been some research that shows that consumers do see it as a positive sort of additional factor when they sign up for something, if they're told that their information will be held securely. But I think this takes us on to the whole identity management question. Is it going to be something that's done via, say, Facebook, where I don't know how many people are aware of Facebook's new Facebook platform. It's creating a lot of waves on the social web because they're opening up Facebook to third-party developers. So effectively they're saying people will authenticate to our identity system and then you can come and, you know, work with them to create extra value. And is that the future, or are we going to find a way of distributing identity so we can all have our own identity servers and keep our own personal information and have services come to us? They're two very different futures.
Microsoft have already tried being the central repository for IDs, I guess, with Passport. Cristiano, have you got a comment on that?
Passport was the first attempt to try to standardize identities on the internet, and as you can imagine, the backlash was massive. A big corporation tried to own your identities. There are other projects that we've seen on the Live platform. We have the Windows Live ID, but there are other projects like the Open ID, if I'm not mistaken, which is an attempt at creating a cross identity that will work across different platforms and not necessarily owned by a large corporation like ourselves.
Is Open ID, which is a distributed system for managing your ID across different sites, is that something that, that you would look at using?
Personally, it would make my life easier, and if I had the guarantee that the specific data that I'm interested in protecting are protected, yeah. Cool. And people would get used and familiar with it. In the same way we now use credit cards with no major issue, 10 years ago we would have been a bit skeptical.
Thanks. We had some more hands up over there. In fact, there's a guy at the back with a black top and a red T-shirt by the door. People scrum their way through the bar, so please be patient.
Hello.
Hello.
Sorry, I can hear myself through the microphone. Hi, I'm Guy. I work for Mind Candy. We're a games company. Some people. I want to just ask you if you think that in some ways the changes which kind of identity is going through as a result of the internet can sometimes have quite positive effects. For instance, see, I have a blog which has my name on it because I'm kind of one of those people who's like, look at me, I'm me, you know, trying to establish kind of an identity online that's authentic. So the question comes up, you know, what do I blog, what do I write about, you know, what's kind of off limits, what's on limits, you know, anyone can read it in the world. And in a way, I think, and the same with my Facebook, because I'm friends with people from my work, and I'm friends with, you know, friends with my girlfriend, or friends with, you know, all these different people who I, you know, went to primary school and barely know now. In a way, you know, I find it kind of keeps you honest. Do you know what I mean? It's like you either have to own something and be like, yeah, this is what I did, and, you know, it's kind of, I'm happy with that, you know. Like, I make really bad music, like really bad music. And, you know, but I'm like, yeah, you know, it's okay. And whereas ordinarily in life, you might kind of be like, it's just the thing I do, and you're really shy, and you want your privacy. You can be like, well, you know, kind of people are going to find it anyway, so you have to own it. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, stuff that you don't want to write about, you're like, okay, that's separate. So essentially, I guess the question I'm asking is, how do you think, you know, in the long term, social networks and things like that will make us maybe think differently about how we, you know, conduct ourselves and think about ourselves online and offline?
James, do you want to, as a fairly high profile corporate brandy type person, do you want to come back on that?
Well, I think it's... if you kind of read the mainstream media with regards to this subject, you imagine that every child, literally every child out there, is going out and sort of just willfully putting naked pictures of themselves up on the internet to attract armies of hideous, you know, Macintosh men.
Can I just interrupt? The first article I found when I was researching this...
Yeah.
Was from the Daily Mail, where they were talking...
Right.
It's my only source for news, clearly. Where they were talking about 13-year-old girls from Tunbridge Wells putting inappropriate pictures of them.
I think somebody should have a serious talk with the man who invented puppies.
But I mean, it's absolutely couldn't be further away from the truth. And the only reason is there's a massive generation gap when it comes to these issues. I mean, the way you've spoken very eloquently there about what it brings to your life, and it's obviously a very positive thing. I think that's the major feeling for most young people. And if anyone is particularly interested in this, they could go and look at Dana Boyd's work in the States, who is basically extremely interesting and a great academic on the subject. But in fact, it's the great example whereby kids and children, young people, are the most sophisticated users of this stuff because they use it all the time.
Technically.
And... No, I'd say in absolutely every single way. They're the most sophisticated, and they're extremely careful. So, like, they you know, the research shows that they will have a number of friends around them, and they're extremely careful if anything comes to them, not through that group of people. And, you know, they're not. It's just so patronising, the mainstream media's approach to say, so if you're approached by someone, you know, you've never met before, and, you know, so you're immediately going to rush out into a dark forest and meet them at 1 o'clock in the morning. It just couldn't be more patronising and further from the truth.
Can I put a question to you? The kids that are online now, and I will accept the point that they're quite sophisticated, not only technically, but how to deal with other human beings and how they use the internet. But the lower the barrier that the entry gets... the less sophisticated your users are going to be. And I think that applies to adults as much as children.
I think I don't quite follow what you're saying. I think
okay, just picture a world where instead of taking driving lessons and having to earn money and buy a car, you can just go out and get a disposable car and drive it from day one. Suddenly the road's a very dangerous place to be. And different people will come a cropper in different ways.
But then they will come a cropper, but then they'll find a way to manage that situation. Because the majority, you know, we're not talking about a bunch of kids, young people with no minds. And I think the main worry seems to be, you know, that classic thing of, a lot of the corporate marketeers that I speak to are worried about this subject because they don't know anything about it. All they know is it's what their kids do for 5 hours upstairs in their bedroom. All they're really doing is talking to their friends, you know, and they say, well, I'm not too happy about that. So I say something, so you'd rather they were sitting downstairs watching the television for 6 hours with you, like I did when I was young, rather than out there sort of talking and socialising with their friends. So I think, you know, just a word for the youth.
Okay, we had another question, I think, in the middle over there. Gentleman in the rather fetching or white short sleeve shirt.
You're very kind.
Thanks.
I like your hair very much as well. Hopefully I'm not taking this conversation in a completely different direction, but we've talked very much about the individual today. And as someone who sold his soul to work in advertising many years ago, I'm kind of curious about what you feel the dark side is for brands if they come into this space.
Yeah, Tim, would you like to come in on that?
Brand targeting is a piece of piss. Large high street brands don't protect their brand enough. They know sweet bugger all about search engine optimization. They worry so much about being the top search result for widgets that they forget their own bloody name.
Tim, when you're talking about targeting, you're talking about swiping their brand identity and using it for your own.
Yes, you don't have to hijack a domain name to compete for the top search result for somebody's brand name. And I can give you a clear example. There was a guy who used a law firm, and the case did not turn out well. And he decided that the law firm was in on it, the police were in on it, there was a whole big conspiracy. You search for the name of the law firm, and the top search results, the law firm. The second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way down to, the 16th result, are all different websites created by the same individual with a beef about the company.
Mike, another perspective on that. You've worked on large social networks inside a media company that sold, I'm imagining, buckets load of advertising. In those environments, what's been your perspective in terms of the brand relationship with those networks?
I think there's two interesting things about... So clearly, from a publisher's perspective, what they're interested in is page impressions, because when you get a page impression, you can serve an ad. I think what's interesting about the social networking arena is, firstly, that group of people are very sensitive to the advertising that gets put next to their content. And that works from the brand's perspective too. And I think the second interesting thing about that, and it varies again from site to site, but this would be really prevalent on something like MySpace, is actually from an advertising point of view and a targeting point of view, actually most of the time you don't know what they're talking about. So there is no targeting on MySpace other than the Google AdWords. So they don't serve really, they can't sell on MySpace display advertising because... Actually, you don't know what the people are talking about most of the time. So Google AdWords works fine because you pick up keywords in the content and you serve AdWords against it, and you know that's the way the money's been made in that particular area. But I think if you're a publisher, it's really, really difficult to monetize, partly because of the sensitivity and partly because who knows how to target that stuff. And I think, you know, technology is starting to catch up with that.
But the danger
from a branding point of view is that you get associated with something that's negative rather than positive, which from an editorial point of view is completely under your control.
Is that your experience as well, Cristiano?
Advertisers have always been very skeptical about advertising social networks because it's an unregulated kind of places. Mind you, the more you can provide them with information about the audience, the more comfortable they become. So I guess you have two approaches. One, you go with display advertising, and again, you have to be respectful, as you said, of the environment. You can't go there with an intrusive ads that plays sounds and expands, so it covers the content, because that will annoy people. And we've got people complaining about expandable, which are overlaid on the text. But the more challenging aspect of advertising on social networking is to become a player, so set up your own profile and start interacting. And that goes deep into the issue that nowadays marketeers face, which is how honest do you have to be to talk to people? and not every company is ready suited to do it. So you open a channel of conversation, that means someone has to be there, someone has to take the nasty comments, and someone has to respond.
Some companies can't do it without significantly changing the way they do business.
I do agree, and that's the cultural challenges that we will perhaps face when social recommendation comes into place, when people start following leads of their social networks to buy products.
We've got another question over here, and one over by the bar as well. So, lady here in the black top.
What's your take on...
Can you tell us where you're from, please?
Oh, sorry, Christina from Designate, an advertising agency. What's your take on negative feedback that's left for these big brands, companies that are out there offering services? Because I've heard recently that TripAdvisor was threatened legal action by hotels because negative feedback was left. And yet, if you leave off the negative feedback, you're sort of... you're letting the consumers down because they're not getting the real authenticity of finding out what people think and the whole...
So
yeah, brands, you know what I mean?
Brands need to be transparent is what you... Or do brands need to be transparent and how transparent? James, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, sure. I thought a really interesting... I mean, it's just a different world. That's the reality. It's a totally different world from traditional media, which is, you know, where you could command the message, control the media. Who here came across the Chevy Tahoe campaign that GM ran in the States?
That's about five hands if you're listening to the podcast.
Right. So very, very quickly, what happened? Chevy Tahoe decided to jump on the latest bandwagon of user-generated media and ask their users to come out and create short 30-second spots for the new Chevy massive, great, big... you know, those huge big vans, whatever they call them in the States, SUVs. And basically what happened was about 2 or 3% of them were basically written by the environmentalist lobby, complaining at the amount of, you know, they were just massive gas guzzlers and bad for the environment. And this was kind of picked up, just that small percentage of adverts were picked up on, and they were thrown back at GM's face saying, this has gone wrong, hasn't it? Isn't it awful? You know, you've been made to look completely ridiculous by your consumers. And GM stuck by it and just said, you know, we don't think that, we don't think that the story that SUVs are bad for the environment is news. And, you know, oh, really? Oh, no, well, now you've brought that to our attention. I'm not going to buy one. And they actually felt that it had basically done the job. It raised the profile, and there was even some sort of hint that basically the people who hate tree huggers bought one for that because of those adverts.
Moonbats,
so it's just a
yes.
New world when, like, you know, all the kind of like new rules happening.
Tim, can you be brief because we've got a couple more questions to get through?
Okay, I hate to go back to identity, but I can quote you at least two examples where a company was receiving a lot of negative feedback by email. Big time waster emails and on the website where possible, and I track the activity back to their direct competitor. Okay, and you've got another example where there was a charity that was under criticism on a separate website, and all these comments started coming in from anonymous members of the public saying, oh, you should, this is a fabulous charity and it's really terrific, and all of those visits were tracked back to the charity.
Mike had a quick comment as well.
I just think from a branding perspective, it comes back to your point about brands not being ready for some of this stuff. And actually, if there's negative comments, then really what they should be doing is listening, because that's the only way that they're actually going to improve the product. And so again, there's another really famous case with the kryptonite bike locks, which if you Google that, yes, you can open with a Bic Biro, right? And it's just a classic case study of not listening and not engaging in the conversation.
So it all comes back to customer service, plain and simple, I guess. We've got another question over by the bar, and then there's another gentleman in a brown top at the back of the room.
I'm Alan Patrick. I co-founded a consultancy called Broadsight, and we blog on broad stuff. The thing we've been working on is, I guess the only word I've got for it is dynamic identity, which is you can find somebody's static identity, but you can also see by their transactions. You can start to understand more about them. One of the issues that that brings out is the level of intimacy that any one social network allows, or the layers of intimacy. Like if you take Facebook, it's like friend, not friend, maybe with a few things. One of the things that occurs to us is if you had far more layers of intimacy or far more nuances in the way a social network worked, you'd actually get over a lot of the gaming issues in these things. I just wondered if anybody else had looked at these issues.
Luke, you've got a comment on that?
I think this takes us into actually a huge topic area that we probably don't have time to cover properly. But
let's keep it short. We're getting thirsty.
Sure, but we must touch on it, because if we're talking about integrated identity, then the whole problem of exchanging data across different ways of describing data on the web is a huge and outstanding problem that hasn't been solved. So you have Facebook saying, you know, there's 8 or 16 different ways you can describe your relationship. Well, human beings don't work like that. We don't think like that. We're much more sophisticated and individual ways of thinking. And we have evolved over a very long time, the ability to understand each other, even when we communicate in different ways. And that's a natural part of our socializing in the physical world. Technology is a long way from doing that. And it's a massive stumbling block for us actually distributing identity and doing
Online identity is basically a pretty rubbish way of identifying yourself on the internet, because you lose all the subtlety.
It's early days.
We had another question over at the back there.
Hi. sorry, excuse me. I just wanted to kind of...
Can you say who you are?
My name is Sam, and I basically blog for whenever I feel like it, really. I don't have another job really at the moment, but it's going well. I basically just wanted to kind of back up the point that I think it was James made about GM, because I actually worked for GM for a little while, and this Chevy Tahoe kind of experience, it kind of divided the marketing people at GM into two camps. One of them was basically, okay, look, see, I told you, doing this kind of thing is bad, we should never touch it again, and social media generally is just not worth it. Let's just kind of continue getting beat by Toyota. And I think the second camp was something that kind of crystallized in the Vauxhall Corsa launch that just happened in September. And that was the creation of these characters called the Commons, who are basically fictional rock stars who are kind of seeded onto MTV. And they seeded these videos out onto YouTube and encouraged people to make their own. And some of the videos that came back were like really pornographic, like basically puppet porn. You know, whatever floats your boat, I guess. But it's something that I think brands need to, number one, educate themselves, because like at GM, the digital marketing team at GM consisted of two and then three people, and then one of them left. So this is the number two car maker in the world, and it's their presence in England. And, you know, I hope none of my former co-workers are here, otherwise I'm getting a bad reference. But, you know, it's just one of those things. I think brands need to, A, work at it, and then, B, embrace the... embrace the backlash, as it were.
I think that's an interesting observation, that brands, how seriously large brands are taking what's clearly a massive sea change in the way that the web's being used. Tim, you had something to add?
I think the risks, particularly for smaller businesses, is if you don't communicate online in a positive way, then all people are going to see is when you get it wrong. You know, there's going to be the official corporate version and that time where it just all went to hell.
I think, has anybody else got any more burning issues? Oh, we got one more. I think we'll make this the last question or two. We'll keep them brief over by the bar here. Because is everyone getting thirsty? I'm getting quite thirsty. So,
I was actually going to ask you, what do you want to drink? It's Ian from EMAP. I just want to know, Mr. Chairman, you mentioned about 8 or 9 issues at the start of the proceedings today. In your mind, which is the biggest one? And in the panel's mind, what's the solution, please?
Good question. I'm not sure we're going to be able to cover that really quickly. For me personally, I think reputation is the big one, and that's, I think, bundled up really, really closely with identity. I don't think anybody's got the faintest idea of how to handle it, and my big bugbear at the moment is your reputation is sprinkled across dozens of different places, from LinkedIn to Facebook to MySpace to your email to your blog to how you're represented on your website. And because it's so dispersed, and you leave this stuff and you forget about it and it sits there and Google's still feeding off it long after you've moved on, you're leaving this trace. And of course there's the archive of the lists that we used to run. Chinwag now gets I'm talking about the Chinwag archive. Tim's mentioning the web archive, with our, obviously, you know, your previous activities are there as well, but we have an archive of emails that have been sent to the UK Net Marketing list, and we probably get 1 or 2 emails a week now from people who are saying, I was really new to the whole industry in 1990, of 1996. I didn't really know what I was talking about, nor did anybody else. Can you please take that post off, because I'm now VP of something big at a major corporate. I look slightly silly. Panel, any solutions in 10 words or less?
You said it. Someone has to solve the reputation and identity problem. That's it. And it's too complex to solve in the next 5 minutes, but I'll see what I can do, all right?
I think some people will learn the hard way how to cope with reputation, and others will understand that perhaps you don't want to post all the pictures of that party. Can you hear me? Yeah, what I was saying is that some people will learn the hard way, others will have it easier, and they will learn not to post all the pictures, because at the end of the day, there are still some aspects of your life that you want to protect. And nowadays, everyone knows how to handle emails, kind of, because of what happened with Claire 5 years ago.
So we need some sacrificial lambs. Mike, you had something to add?
I just think that the people who make the mistakes, because of the way the media is globally now, those mistakes will be amplified, and everybody will learn about that. And I think if you look at the statistics, there's probably no more or less nutters, paedophiles, lunatics, weirdos, stalkers in the world now than there were 100 years ago. It's just that from a media perspective, those get blown up. And so the lessons that are learned will be learned by a lot more people a lot faster, and the results of that will be learned a lot faster. And I think people will just get a balance, and I think it'll correct itself. It's always going to happen. But, you know, statistically, the number of people that are the number of kids that are abducted by people who don't know them hasn't changed for the last 30 years. Right, it's between 6 and 8 kids a year, and it hasn't been affected by mobile phones, CB radio, internet, TV nasties. It hasn't been affected by any of that stuff. It's been pretty consistent. What's changed has been the media perception of that and the media expansion of that. So I think that will fuel the balancing.
Luke, you had a point.
I guess going back to the reputation point, I was thinking maybe the flip side of authenticity is compassion and acceptance. You know, we were talking about sort of sexual shame and things like that. And I felt pretty embarrassed when I froze up at the beginning of this. But
With friends, don't be embarrassed.
Exactly, and that feels really good. And I think that's maybe a social change, that we're learning to be more accepting of ourselves and each other, and that's a great thing.
Cool. James?
I just found one really handy thing on my blog is just ignore and delete anonymous commentators.
I think that goes for email and all the other spams. We've got Deirdre, you've got a question?
Yeah. I went to a conference last week that Dan Gilmore spoke at. If anyone doesn't know, he's the author of a book, We the Media, and he's a very well-respected commentator. And he was talking about social media, and he made the point that we need to cut each other some slack. So, like, for instance, with things like, Facebook, MySpace, and the whole problem, or not the problem, but the fact that a lot of your life is being cached and saved, and even if you delete the thing, it'll still be there somewhere. He basically said, are we going to hold each other up to the standard of the stupidest thing we ever did for the rest of our lives? Or are we going to cut each other some slack? And this is what I think is really interesting, because if notions of privacy are changing, there is a lot of people who are going to get burnt, but it is a cultural shift. And a question I have, there isn't time to be answered, is like, who is going to protect the people who are going to be sacked for some silly comment or putting up some photographs of them out drinking or something? So
it's already happening in the blogosphere. But we should probably talk about this in the office. I should point out Deirdre is the editor of chinwag.com, which is why I didn't. We've got one last question over at the back.
Hi, my name is Leanne. I'm from the NSPCC. And obviously we have a really strong interest and in social networking, mainly from the fact that we want to, obviously our aim is to protect children online. My question is kind of twofold. One is we've successfully used online or social networks, specifically Bebo, for our campaigns, because we actually target our messages to children around, obviously, online safety and stuff in these networks, because we know we can't get them to our site. We'd rather get into the spaces that they're in, and that's worked really well for us. Second to that is that, obviously, we do have a very strong awareness of what is happening online with children, and I think you downplay it when you say, there's not many kids that have been kidnapped and or abducted, etc. I think the situation is quite serious. I think from an identity point of view, kids give away a hell of a lot of information. And we need to, obviously, as an organization and with other charities, work on a way of protecting children online, and basically we're doing work in that arena now. My question, it kind of boils down to, how do you see children being vetted, or not vetted, but the fact is, you know, if I sign up and I say I'm 13 years old, who checks that? How do we get around that, the fact that anyone can sign up, pretend that they're a certain age, and get into these teenage networks or these children networks?
So we're back to the how do you verify someone's identity in the real world from their online presence, I think.
Yeah, and obviously then with the aim of protecting children.
Luke, do you want to come back on that quickly?
Well, obviously it's a huge topic. And in this country we have the government seeking to develop this ID card, which originally was going to be a fairly draconian scheme that would really know, they would know a lot about us, and we'd have to use this card to for public services and what have you. I don't know how it's going to play out, really. It's a very complex issue.
So no answers, we need to keep looking. And I think with that we'll draw the panel to a close. Everyone's getting warm and no doubt would like to hit the bar. However hard they'd like to hit it, that's fine with us. I would just like to say a very big thank you to our panels, Tim Ireland from Bloggerhead, Mike Barrett from Compound Media, James Cherkov from Collaborate Marketing, Cristiano Ventura from Windows Live Spaces, got the brand right, yay, and Luke Rozell from the Identity Society. I'd also like to thank our sponsors, CNET Networks UK, our media sponsors, and AdTech London 2007, 26th, 27th of September down at Olympia. And thank you for Duncan for helping on the door. Well, the last thing I'll say is the Big Summer 07 Chinwag party at, sorry, networking event, not a party, obviously, at Imperial College is getting a lot of registrations. We will have to cap it relatively soon. So if you would like to come along, it's on the 5th of July. Please join us. There's free drinks, barbecue, entertainment, casino. Sign up at bigsummer.chinwag.com. Thanks very much.